ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. Is a $36 billion takeover bid for Santos on track or derailing? Santos has provided a market update today. I'll be sharing the details of that with you in just a second. Also this afternoon, a trip across the border to far north Queensland, where farmers are celebrating some bumper yields for their dryland cotton crops.
Oh, we were expecting, if we got it all going again, good, we'd probably get 6 bales or something, and that would be, we'd be happy at that. But paddock we're sitting in front of now is doing 8.6, so that's very, very encouraging.
Yeah, more than 8 bales a hectare for dryland cotton. I'll tell you more about that soon. You'll also this afternoon hear about plans to bring 100 big rigs into Alice Springs later this month.
So we've got 100 trucks already booked in, and they're coming from every single state in Australia, including Tasmania. There's a lot of chrome, a lot of bling that, you know, is really good for kids and for public to see, you know.
And they're all headed towards Alice Springs. I'll tell you why this afternoon on the Country Hour. We are broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC, and g'day if you've tuned in via the podcast. First to some resources news. A proposed $36 billion takeover of oil and gas giant Santos has hit some delays. In a statement to the ASX today, Santos says it has not reached an agreement with the consortium from Abu Dhabi, and the exclusive due diligence period is set to expire this Friday. Now, is this just a bit of a delay and a small hurdle to this sale, or is there something else going on? Fiona Broome spoke to Tony Wood, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate Change at the Grattan Institute, to learn more about today's announcement and to get a sense on what this overseas consortium is hoping to do.
XRG itself is a subsidiary of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, which obviously is a government-owned Abu Dhabi company. And they set up this company called XRG to try and grow a globally significant oil and gas company. In addition to that, they have a partner called Carlyle, who is a well-known financial organisation globally, and together they put together this consortium, which some weeks ago now put forward a non-binding bid to buy Santos. Santos being one of Australia's leading gas companies with operations across Australia, but also opportunities overseas as well.
And where is that process at today? What has just been announced this morning with regards to this deal?
Well, back earlier this month, the consortium announced that they'd done most of their due diligence and that they were proceeding. Sometimes things can happen that they find something they just didn't like and they just stop. That's not happened. But what they did do was extend the exclusivity period. That's this period in which the board of Santos gives the bidder exclusive opportunity to go and really do some detailed investigation with the help of the Santos organisation into certain whatever issues they want to have a look at. And, you know, the Santos board have, again, not completely open door, but they've certainly allowed this exclusive period for the consortium to proceed to, hopefully, in their view, eventually provide a firm binding bid. So that's what's happened now. That was extended to this Friday. It's always good practice for the people in this situation, particularly a company like Santos that is listed in Australia on the stock exchange, to advise the market of how this is going. And what they did today was announce that don't expect to have a binding agreement by this Friday. And that's just good due process, I would suggest. And what they're looking to come up with eventually is either the consortium walks away, or they come up with what's called a binding scheme implementation agreement. That is that both parties said, yes, we're going to do this. Now, there's still some, you know, there are still regulatory approvals with both the state and federal government, state meaning South Australia, to go yet. But that would be the next step. And I think what they've said is it's going to take us a while yet. XRG has said, look, We've got a number of internal decision-making processes. It's not just a single company that's making this bid. As we said, there's a couple of entities in here that have to come to an agreement themselves. So, you know, they're saying that could take anywhere up to another 4 weeks, maybe longer. So I think it's just good practice to say for the Santos to advise the market that the original date of this Friday will not be met. But up until now, that has not meant that the deal is falling over by any means.
So you think this proposed takeover of Santos by the XRG consortium will still go ahead? It doesn't open it up to others to make bids for Santos?
Ah, no, I didn't say that. No, I think it means that it hasn't run into roadblocks. It doesn't mean that there's some not challenges ahead. So there's two or three things going on here. One is that the detailed investigation that XRG have to do for their own purposes is continuing, and that's what they announced today. It's not clear as to whether or not the exclusive period that was granted by the board of Santos to the XRG consortium, whether that exclusivity will be extended or whether they will say, the board of Santos says, look, you guys haven't agreed to give us a binding commitment. We're now getting frustrated. We're going to open it up to potential other bidders. That doesn't mean there's other bidders waiting in the wings, but there could be. And of course, behind all this is, if it gets to the next stage, would be serious consideration by the federal government. So there are a number of steps here. The good news on this from a Santos perspective and presumably XRG is their process is continuing. I don't see the announcement today as being particularly positive or negative, but it's just part of what's turning out to be maybe a bit more complicated process than either party had initially anticipated.
Why is this consortium interested in Santos?
Well, no, I guess I wasn't inside the room, but I can only assume that when the XRG was looking to provide or build this globally significant gas company, it looked around at companies that they thought would provide that opportunity, but also a company that was valued at the appropriate price. And I think there's been a lot of concerns generally that Santos is maybe undervalued by the market. You know, the deal that Santos and Woodside tried to put together for a merger did not succeed. And you know, the board of Santos, while they haven't yet completely endorsed this bid, did give the bidders, the consortium, an exclusive period to have a closer look. They put in a non-binding bid. That means non-binding means that subject to certain outcomes that are now working through. You know, Santos has, as I said, some interesting activities. You know, in Australia, it's been around for many decades. Operations mainland Australia, PNG, offshore, both north and south and west of Australia. But it also has some opportunities overseas. It picked up as a result of some stuff it bought not very long ago. It's got operations, as I said, in PNG, but also even in Alaska. So I think they've seen this as a good platform. Australia, I would like to think, it also sees that as a company domiciled here as a valuable company, and that's what they've decided to proceed with. That's their side of the process so far.
That's Tony Wood, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate Change at the Grattan Institute. Just yesterday, the ABC's Chief Business Correspondent, Ian Verinder, he wrote an interesting article that was called Selling Out or Selling Up? The Battle for Santos Takes a Twist. I'll just share a little bit of that article with you now. He wrote, had the Australian government announced plans to purchase Santos, there undoubtedly would have been furious debate over the nationalisation of a vitally important commercial operation. Instead, we've got a foreign government with potentially shifting global allegiances and a track record of dubious activities across Africa and Asia has stumped up a stupendous amount of cash for the same crucial energy infrastructure with barely a hint of community or political questioning. You can find that article up on the ABC News website. As we go to air this afternoon, shares in Santos are down by 2.7%. Year to date, its share price has risen by 14.3%. Of course, Santos runs the Darwin LNG processing facility. It wants to develop the Barossa project off the coast and has interests in the Beetaloo Basin.
Yeah, g'day, how you going? My name's Jason Moon, owner of NT Tropical Passion Fruit. We're on the farm today and you're listening to the Country Hour.
It's 20 to 1. Northern Territory fire authorities have declared a 24-hour fire ban for the Darwin and Adelaide River fire weather forecast areas. So this includes Darwin, Palmerston, Kamali and Litchfield. It means no one in those areas can light or cause a fire to be lit. And this ban will be in place until midnight tonight. And as we go to air this afternoon, there's several bushfire advices in place, including for blazes that are currently in Litchfield National Park. There's also a fire along the Stuart Highway near the Douglas Daly, Dorisvale Road, and there's also a fire this afternoon near Dickwood Drive in Ludmilla.
A bushfire survival plan is one of the best ways to ensure the safety of you and your family. It will stop you making potentially dangerous last-minute decisions and help you decide what to do before, during, and after a fire. Go to abc.net.au/emergency to develop your bushfire survival plan and discuss the plan with your entire family. ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory, your emergency broadcaster.
Right across the territory on the ABC, you are tuned into the Country Hour. The cotton harvest in the Northern Territory, it's coming to an end, but over in Queensland, things are ramping up. And some of the yields in the far north of Queensland have been huge. I'll tell you more about it next. This is the Country Hour. A reminder, if you need to duck out into the paddock for whatever reason, you can always download the podcast and listen at a time that suits you. Now, as the cotton harvest draws to a close here in the Northern Territory, it is starting to ramp up in far north Queensland. Now, like the Territory, most of the North Queensland crop is dry land, meaning the cotton is relying on whatever rain it gets during the wet season months. As Sophie Johnson reports, it's shaping up to be one of the region's best cotton crops ever.
Cotton harvest is underway in far north Queensland. Agronomist Marilio Resende says it's the best he's ever seen.
Well, we're getting a really good result. It's a fantastic result, really. We had a perfect year to finish. We had a perfect finish. The cotton starts really well. We just had enough rains just to keep, you know, the season tick along. Normally, on previous years, what's been happening is we've been getting too much rain up front. You can either lose some areas and we can't replant. You know, we have eight weeks to plant the cotton up here. And this year, everything lined up and the crops come up really well everywhere. Up to late January, so early February, we got a bigger event. So this farm here had about 700 mils of rain in 2 weeks. And all the cotton, not just on this farm, but all the cotton shed a lot of the fruit. Historically, we've been building up. We've been getting the yield on the bottom part of the crop. And this year, we lost all that bottom fruit. But we had the season to finish the top. So, yeah, it's fantastic results, really. It's the best season I've ever seen up here, for sure, yeah.
The industry is in its infancy across the Atherton Tablelands and further west. At St. Ronan's Station in 40 Mile, 230 kilometres southwest of Cairns, farm manager Luke Crossley has been growing cotton for about 6 years. He's very happy with how this season wrapped up.
So it was a pretty wet beginning in the season, but once we started going, it turned out to be an unreal season for dry land and irrigated. Averaged about 10, 11 bales consistently over the irrigation and anywhere from 6 to 7 in dry land. Great wet season for us and some pretty good weather at the start. Kicked it all off. So every year we keep getting better yields and consistency. So every year, yeah, we'll keep making the same or more improvements and hopefully keep getting that yield up.
Up the road at Innet Hot Springs near Ravenshoe, Ross Johnson has been pleasantly surprised by how well his crop turned around.
Well, it was the most terrible season ever back in February when it got so much rain on it. It was pretty devastating, actually. Like, paddocks were completely underwater. And we thought, and the year before was so bad with Cyclone Jasper as well with the cotton, so we thought we were in for another bad year. But favourable weather and refertilising some areas and good agronomy and that sort of thing, it bounced back, and it's bounced back to an extraordinary, unbelievable situation at the moment, yeah. Oh, we were expecting, if we got it all going again, good, we'd probably get 6 bales or something, and we'd be happy at that. But this paddock we're sitting in front of now is doing 8.6, so that's very, very encouraging. and we've got our irrigated paddocks to go yet, and we think they may do more. They were, had a bit more fertiliser put on them, looked after a bit better with water. But this is dry land, and that's a pretty extraordinary result, I think, for dry land crop.
The success makes him a little emotional.
Oh, it's a little bit overwhelming compared to what it was. So it's gone from disaster to it's incredible.
Mr. Resende says the region typically sees 3 to 5 bales per hectare on dry land, but this season it's averaging closer to 7. He expects it will encourage more growers to give cotton a go.
It's a lot of opportunity to grow up here. So we certainly have the area, we certainly have enough moisture to grow the crop. We just need to get a bit more consistent yields to, you know, prove the crop can be grown here and then attract a gene and, you know, and then the industry is going to be on the way. Yeah, a couple of years ago, we had a bunch of new growers jump in and decide to grow cotton. Yeah, I reckon there is growers that grows in the past. There's a lot of growers to grow again. It's just the growing cost is quite high with picking and freight. And we need a bit better cotton price to justify growing, like the risk, you know, the risk reward being a little bit higher. So I reckon if we see cotton again around that 700 plus, so definitely will be a lot more growers growing again.
The nearest cotton gin for far north Queensland growers is about 1,000 kilometres south in Emerald. But if the industry continues on its current trajectory, Mr. Resende sees potential for a processing facility to be established closer to home.
We just need the area to grow, and you know, and the area is going to grow with a bit more consistent yields. So as more we get consistent yields, the air is going to grow, and then the gin will follow for sure.
That's Queensland cotton grower Murillo Resende speaking to Sophie Johnson. So how about that? Some of the dryland crops in far north Queensland yielding 7 to over 8 bales per hectare, which is good. At current prices, if you're getting about 8 bales a hectare, that's a bit over $4,500 a hectare in the rangeland country of far north Queensland. Now, last week, the Country Hour was broadcast from the official opening of the brand new cotton gin in Kununurra. During that broadcast, I spoke to Simon Cameron from Cotton Australia, who said right across northern Australia, so across the top of WA, the Territory and Queensland, there's about 30,000 hectares of cotton being grown this year. And she mentioned North Queensland and how there's potentially momentum building over there for some local processing as well.
I was speaking to a couple of growers over in far north Queensland last week about how they've gone over there and what they're seeing, and there's a renewed sparked interest. I think, you know, this whole messaging around northern Australia and key developments that are happening infrastructure-wise, i.e. we now have 2 cotton gins for cotton processing facilities in the northern parts of Australia.
Does northern Queensland want its one as well?
Well, yes, there's a little murmur. I'm hearing a murmur. Like it's a little, you know, a whisper yep. in the wind, but essentially, from what I understand, the logistics of getting their cotton into the Emerald region for processing has been okay.
Okay.
And transport costs have been okay.
Not nearly as extreme as those who have been trying to grow cotton in the Ord. It's a long way to Dalby from here.
It's a long way.
So you've said 30,000 hectares, roughly, of cotton
yes.
across the north. There's now 2 gins. Can 2 gins be viable in this current environment?
Yes, they will be, but this will take time. And as was mentioned in some of the amazing presentations this morning with some of our chief players that have helped bring this gin to life over here, it's all about that long game. So yep. the future proofing of the northern parts of Australia, it's the chicken and egg. If we don't have the infrastructure, we'll only ever stall out at so many, you know, for that production system. So it's now about bedding it down and getting it happening. The next big part of the piece is, well, our major markets for the global trade of cotton, of which Australia is the finest cotton producer in the world. We only produce 4% of the global trade. That's not a lot. But our markets are just a few hours away from us here in the north. So China, Vietnam and Indonesia.
That is Simon Cameron from Cotton Australia speaking to me at the official opening of the Kimberley Cotton Gin on the outskirts of Kununurra. If you missed that special broadcast, you can find the podcast via our website or wherever you get your favourite podcasts from. Now, when it comes to growing cotton in tropical conditions, arguably Brazil is the absolute champion of it. In 2023-24, Brazil became the world's largest cotton exporter, surpassing the United States. Australia sits at number three on that list. Cotton grower Hamish McIntyre has this month been on a Brazil cotton tour to see what's driving that country's expanding cotton industry.
The majority of their crop is rain grown with very high rainfall. You know, they have between 1,200 to 2,200 millimetres a year. And it actually enables them in one of the states, Mato Grosso, to grow two crops in the calendar year, which is quite amazing. You know, they plant soybeans in September and grow a yield of about 3.5 tonne a hectare, harvesting them in January, and then plant cotton straight into the soybean stubble in January, and then proceed to grow another sort of 7 to 9 bale rain-grown cotton crop, which they're harvesting now. So it gets harvested from late July into August. A very sort of powerful system that enables them to produce two crops a year, which obviously we can't do in our areas, but it could be relevant to parts of northern Australia going forward if the rain falls at the right time for them.
Do they do any irrigated cropping at all, or is it mostly the rain-fed just due to that high rainfall?
Yeah, the majority is rain-fed, but they certainly do irrigation in areas, particularly using, you know, perch tables with pivots. The water seems to be down about 150 to 200 metres, particularly in Bahia. So it's sort of supplementary irrigation that, you know, today we saw the scales extraordinary. We saw, you know, centre pivots that are doing 470 hectares. So, you know, had a radius of 1.2 kilometres, you know, approximately 25% of the area in Bahia can be irrigated if they wish to, but it's not all grown with pure irrigation, if that makes sense. So they definitely just add some water to help keep pushing these crops along in amongst the rain. And the quality of their cotton too, you know, we've been hearing that it's well behind ours. Well, I'm afraid it's not. You know, it's maybe a little bit shorter, but their colour, their mic can be a little bit higher, but they gin to a four-leaf, or we gin to a three-leaf. They certainly aren't far behind us. We've all been very impressed with, you know, their production standards, the machinery, all the technologies we've got, they've got, but they're doing it at huge scale. I mean, you'll see 28 pickers on a family farm. It's, you know, modern John Deere pickers. So it's quite a sight.
Do they use the same Bollgard cotton that we do? Are they GM, or what's the go there in terms of varieties?
They do, yes. There's a lot of Australian Fibermax type germplasm here still. They've developed their own varieties. They can keep their own seed as farmers here and delint it and use it again where we can't.
Right.
So that's a different production system. Look, they're producing in that double crop scenario, as I said before, they're producing, you know, 3.5 tonne of soy and then a 7 to 9 bale a hectare cotton crop. Then we're in Bahia where it is a little bit drier, back to 1,200 millimetres, which is still wet for us, where they're doing more irrigation. We've seen plenty of pivot cotton that's, 9, 10, 11 bales a hectare with that supplementary irrigation. So it's all the technologies we've got, they've got, but we think that they're in dangerous space, as we were in the Australian industry back in the 1990s, when we were, you know, our IPM program helped us, and, you know, incredibly, you don't see a lot of beneficial insects here with the way they manage their crops, where, you know, we have developed a more robust system in Australia that extends the life of our traits that we have access to, where over here they really have lost, you know, control of the proteins in the traits. So they're using non-selective chemistry to control things, which we learnt the hard way doesn't work in the long term. So time will tell, but at the moment they're still producing very good yields and about the same cost we are.
Okay. And do you think you'll pick up any innovations from them, or do you think you're already at a pretty innovative level back home?
Well, we certainly are. You know, we're where they are. There's some great stuff around the ginning space that we've seen, where they, you know, are using the byproducts to make cotton cake, which is, you know, they're crushing their seed oil to produce oil, and they're everything's getting utilised more and at a higher value, turning it into animal protein than we are, which is very impressive. We haven't seen these compressing the cotton gin trash into cake before, and it's amazing. So that sort of thing we could definitely take home to Australia if we're allowed to use those byproducts as they do going forward.
That is cotton grower Hamish McIntyre, who's in Brazil at the moment. He was speaking to Brandon Long.
G'day, my name's Isabel Heffernan and I'm a business analyst based at Amundi Station. So there's more than just running cattle and chasing cows around. There's a lot going on behind the scenes in the office. There's always an excuse to get onto Excel and make some data-driven decisions. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. If you're in the Katherine region and have a mango tree in the backyard or out in the paddock, I wonder how it's looking. In a moment, you'll hear from a Katherine mango grower who's getting a bit excited about what he is seeing out there in the orchard. Mitchell Curtis on your radio in a moment. Also, before 1:30, a look at what is being done to slow the spread of foot and mouth disease and lumpy skin disease in Indonesia. First, let's go to the Weather Bureau. Sally Cutter's there this afternoon. How are you, Sally?
Oh, not too bad, thanks.
There's a fire ban in place this afternoon for the Darwin region and the Adelaide River fire forecast area. And there's a number of fires out in our landscape today. What are conditions like?
Yeah, it's quite dry, so the winds are just starting to ease off. But, so it's still a bit windy out there and quite dry.
Hey, Sally Cutter, you know what, here at the ABC, yep. I've got what we call a promo. How about I play that, you get yourself a glass of water, and we'll get back into this. Stand by.
Adds colour and life to your garden. Get tips on growing classic annuals, flannel flowers, potted fruit trees, blueberries and bird-friendly plants. It's all in Gardening Australia magazine from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
There you go, Sally. Is that giving you a moment to clear the frog and grab a glass of water?
A glass of water was out. The nearest kitchen, somebody's got the door shut and I've got to run right the way across the other side of the office. So we'll see how we go.
You've done beautifully and you sound fantastic. We were talking about the smoke, ironically, and the fire conditions. What's happening?
As you can tell, the air is quite dry. In fact, it's really dry. If anybody's interested in dew points around the Darwin area, we're down around 2 or 3 degrees. If you're down Tyndall, we've got -2.5 for its dew point. So it's really, really dry air. It's been windy this morning. The winds are easing off now, but it's just all combining with those temperatures to give some really we have recorded extreme fire dangers at Noonamah today, and high. So it's conditions are just right to help the fires.
Yeah, I know out where the Bureau's office is there near Casuarina, lots of big glass windows. What's it looking outside at the moment? Is it noticeably hazy?
We've actually moved into town.
I've missed that, sorry.
That's okay. You can see across the harbour. It has been worse.
Yep.
But it could also be the time of day, so the sun's overhead, or more or less overhead, so it's not accentuating the haze. But the sky does look rather murky.
Okay. For those who are battling fires, when can these type of conditions be set to ease?
The winds will ease off as we go through into the weekend. So the top end, we've still got the wind, a little bit of wind out there, probably not the fresh winds, and they might be easing off a little bit some more during the afternoon, but we're still going to have those winds up a bit. We did go a bit more easterly, so we will see return of fogs, which is just indicating that there's more moisture in the atmosphere or down near the surface. So we could see some fogs over the weekend. So unfortunately, we might be sort of pushing it sort of late into sort of Friday sort of time frame. So, but then if you're down south, or part of it, or that's helping the winds ease off is Crofts coming through down south, and we've got a fairly major one coming through on Monday, Tuesday. So that's really easing the winds in the north, but then it's making it windy down south.
Okay. And there is a marine wind warning out as well?
Yep. Yeah, so that's for east, both sides of the coast, and then tomorrow we've got the east coast of the in the Gulf Covent area, so the Roper Group coastal area, and at the moment it's the 10 o'clock, it's been contracted into the Roper Groups, but it's still, the winds are easing on the east coast and the north coast, but tomorrow they're going to pick up again on the east.
Anything else we should be aware of this afternoon, Sally?
No, just the fact that it's really dry out there today and windy, and the winds are going to ease off. But even through the Barkly, it's a bit windy tomorrow morning, but the fire danger is still going to remain up into that high range.
Yeah. All right, then. Thanks so much for your time.
That's okay.
Enjoy that water.
Will do.
That's Sally Cutter at the Weather Bureau. It is 10 past one. Just repeating, there is a 24-hour fire ban in place for Darwin and Adelaide River fire weather forecast areas. I've mentioned there's a few fires out near Dorisvale Road, Litchfield National Park. There's even one in town at Dick Ward Drive in Ludmilla. And just looking at the NAFI website this afternoon, looks like some fires have really got out of hand on Jindare Station. This is southwest of Pine Creek, and a lot of fire still on Manbaloo Cattle Station to the south of Katherine.
My name's Jess Daniels. I'm a biosecurity liaison with the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association, and you're listening to Country Hour.
And a shout out to everyone tuning in around the Katherine region via 106.1 FM. I'm told there's a bit of excitement around Katherine's mango industry at the moment, with the local orchards covered in flowers and early fruit set. Things are looking the goods. There's still a lot that can happen between now and harvest time, but growers like Mitchell Curtis are feeling optimistic about the upcoming season.
Yeah, really great. We got a fantastic flowering, so which is surprising because last year was a big crop. Usually they're down a little bit the following year, so it isn't as good as last year. But I think we're very happy with it, so it should be a good season.
And what's happening at the farm these days in this last couple of weeks?
So we've started our spray program over the flowers to make sure that there's nothing can attack the flowers when they're tiny. So a mango is like a balloon. If you put a mark on a balloon then blow it up, it blows up much bigger. So if we get tiny little marks on the baby mangoes, when they're big, you'll see a big mark. So we've got to make sure they're clean right now. So we just monitor very closely what's happening in the orchard. And then if we discover there's something like thrips or something, we'll just go and spray those and keep track of them. So that spray thing happens for about 3 weeks. So we're in full flower, we're setting fruit, and so we'll just keep that very clean until the fruit's at about an egg size. So could be about 4 weeks that we're doing that. That's our main focus. It's the most critical thing at the moment.
What are you hoping for the season ahead?
So we're hoping, like the last few years, we've clashed with other regions a little bit. This year, I think we're in a much better place not to do that. There's some late flowering in Darwin, but whether they get that or not, I'm not sure. But predominantly the fruit that's up there now will be finished before we start. There may be some later orchards, but yesterday I went out to look all around Darwin just to get my head around what's happening, and I didn't see too much threat. And then once we've established that and we can get the fruit off, that means we'll have trucking will be more available, the labour will be more available. All those processes, if we're not clashing, it's not doubling up on all the workforce and the trucks and everything. So hopefully that flows through, and then the fruit will flow through the market much better at that as well. So Darwin gets their fruit through, then that eases up, and then Katherine comes in fairly strong. So, and then hopefully we don't clash with Queensland, but my understanding is that it's not going to for KPs. So I think we should be in a reasonable season to get a good return.
When are you expecting picking and harvest to start?
So we think we're going to start around the 25th of October for our Katherine fruit on Fox Road. So, which traditionally, a lot of people are saying, oh, it's late, but when Dad had the farm for the last 30 years, traditionally it was around the 23rd to the 25th of October. I think the last 3 to 4 years have been a bit earlier, so we start to think, oh, we're running late, but we are pretty spot on the timing that Katherine usually rests at.
What do you see as some challenges ahead for the seasonal workforce?
Oh, it's just getting more and more difficult with our seasonal workforce. The issues aren't so much to whether or not we can get them, because mangoes are one of the first fruits to start, so people are itching to get going. It's just the productivity around our workforce and how much we have to pay them now. You know, the wages are continuously going up, and it doesn't matter if you're skilled or unskilled, you're still getting paid a really good wage. But the price of our product doesn't go up. So Coles and Woolies and the market are always trying to push it down to hit a price point that the consumer can purchase that fruit, more than one or two, want to be able to grab a handful of the fruit. But, you know, it's just becoming so much more difficult the last 3-4 years to be able to hit those price points and hit our labour tasks. So, yeah, it's tricky. Farming's tricky at the moment.
And if you could click your fingers and have the best season ahead, what would that look like?
We'd have low diesel prices, labour that is highly productive, and amazing prices. So that would be the ideal scenario. You know, the last 2 or 3 years have been very difficult, and you know, some of those years we haven't even covered our costs, and other years we've only just got over it. So if we have an amazing season, have a catch-up, we'd be very, very happy.
Fingers crossed. That is Catherine Mango grower Mitchell Curtis from Kings Farm speaking to Christine Schindler, who's got a big few days ahead. I think Christine's about to jump into the vehicle and start heading west towards Bullow River Cattle Station. There's a field day on there tomorrow. If you're interested, I reckon you could call the Department of Ag and probably still get yourself a ticket to it if you're keen. But the Country Hour will be there to bring you all of the action and info.
Do you know a young person with a story to tell?
Hey, well, has a chance to
tell our stories on a national platform.
Go to Canberra, go out, make change.
And be heard.
Enter by September 1st.
abc.net.au/Haywire.
It is 16 past one and you are tuned into the Country Hour. It's been 3 years since foot and mouth disease and lumpy skin disease were found in Indonesia. And while these livestock diseases have not been eradicated, there has been a lot of work done to try and slow their spread. LiveCorp and Cattle Australia, they've been involved in workshops in East Java this month. To learn more about that, I had a chat to LiveCorp Chief Executive Wayne Collier.
Yeah, so we've been running a series of workshops since 2022 when FMD and LSD were detected in Indonesia. To provide smallholder farmers, animal health staff, local government officials support in increasing and getting more knowledge around the diseases, applicable biosecurity mechanisms and measures for their specific circumstances, and then how to manage the diseases and how to prevent them through things like vaccination. So we've done it across Indonesia. We've done work in Sumatra and West Java, and we've just this last week we've been in East Java where we ran workshops for the smallholder farmers there, and it's been great. And the feedback that I got from the one last week was that just the people were so proud that they've been able to be involved, you know. And for us, it's just great to see that, you know, hundreds of people who have the opportunity to spread that knowledge and protect their livelihoods, you know, being able to access that.
Right, that's the sort of attendance at some of these workshops, is it? Hundreds of people coming along?
Yeah, it is, yeah. So hundreds of people from across the community. So I think that's one of the key things we've done is we've partnered with the Gavis Findo, the industry association in Indonesia that has a lot of these contacts. And they've worked through the community. So, yeah, you're getting all sorts of people coming in from across those sort of regions. So, yeah, no, hundreds of people at each workshop.
And what's the latest on the vaccination rollout? Because I know this program's involved in that a bit.
Yeah, so there's sort of a combination. So we've run, like I said, a couple of different series of activities. So through the work that we've done, there's been sort of over 400,000 imported livestock from Australia, or imported cattle from Australia, vaccinated through a reimbursement program we ran early on. But since then, you know, the vaccination of imported cattle has become basically common practice, part of business for importers, exporters importing from Australia. Through the work we've done, there's another sort of 30, 40,000 local animals that we've been able to support the vaccination of, which, you know, sounds maybe reasonably small, but when each farmer has one, two animals, it's a big impact. But on top of that, obviously, the Indonesian government has been rolling out vaccinations across the country as well, you know, well into the millions. So,
Wayne, is it common practice now for Aussie animals to step off the boat in Indonesia and sort of be vaccinated straight away for both of them, foot and mouth disease and lumpy skin disease?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, right. Yeah. Because obviously the key thing is, you know, when you're bringing them into the feed, like, you want to protect them because they're going in to be fed and fattened over the next period to sell. So you want to protect, obviously, that investment, but also make sure that their welfare is protected. So, no, it's common practice to do that.
And so both of these diseases, they're still there. They have not been eradicated, but the spread of them, is it slowing down? Is the industry having a bit of a win?
Look, I don't have the specific details. Obviously, that's something that the Indonesian government would report on. But it's obviously still being reported in market. The fact that, you know, we're still holding these workshops shows, I think, the importance that's being put out there in terms of how Indonesia wants to proactively manage what's happening. So, look, it's challenging. It's definitely there in market, but, you know, at the moment I don't have the details specifically on the spread, but I guess we keep working on it to try and manage it so that the impact's less.
Hmm. And why is it important to help Indonesia with this?
Yeah, look, I think one of the critical parts, obviously Australia's been a key partner, and the Australian cattle sector, and particularly the northern cattle sector, has been a partner with Indonesia and the importers there for decades. You know, and I think it's important that we keep investing in that partnership, not purely as a trade partnership, but as something where, you know, where we collectively are looking after each other and the challenges that come up. So, you know, I think this it's an investment, it's a commitment to work with Indonesia and with the feedlots to support them and the communities that surround them. But also, you know, there is an element, obviously, of it helps to contribute to slowing the spread of disease, like you mentioned, and making sure that, that, you know, there's conditions around feedlots where we're trying to minimise the occurrence of disease as well. So, but, yeah, it's really about that committed partnership and making sure that we're standing with them with the challenges that are faced.
Thanks for your time this afternoon. Appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks a lot.
Wayne Collier, he's the Chief Executive of Life Corp. You are tuned into the Country Hour. It's 22 past one. Just quickly, the Australian Forest Products Association has today welcomed the federal government's latest round of funding for forestry projects via what's known as the Support Plantation Establishment Program. So 15 new projects are going to share in $19 million worth of grants. And it seems the Territory is going to be a big winner in all of this, with about $10 million going to the Tiwi plantations to help establish new hardwood plantations. I assume all of this will be happening on Melville Island. So the NT and the Tiwi Islands, big winners out of round three of this federal program. Hopefully we can chat to someone about this on tomorrow's Country Hour. $10 million headed towards forestry projects on the Tiwi Islands. I can also tell you there's about 100 big trucks getting ready to head to Alice Springs. Why are the big rigs coming to the Red Centre? You'll find out next.
Yeah, and my name's Nick Ferrica from Road Trains of Australia, and I've just unloaded here at the Berrima Export Yard. And when I'm cruising along, I always tune into the Country Hour.
The National Road Transport Museum is getting ready to celebrate its 30th birthday later this month by bringing over 100 big rigs into Alice Springs as part of the Australian Festival of Transport. Museum Chairman Franco Bellato says it'll hopefully be a big event, not just for the trucking industry, but for the whole town.
Yeah, I'm very pumped for it. It's going to be a big one. It's been 30 years, and so, yeah, it's going to be really good. We've got a lot of trucks coming in from interstate, a lot of people getting inducted into the hall this year. And, yeah, all preparations are looking very good. So, yeah, we're hoping to bring in a lot of people into the town. And, yeah, no, it's been very, very exciting. The level of people wanting to come here and be part of the festival has just been second to none. It's been really, really great to see it back on track again.
30 years of history at the museum, that must make this year's festival that little bit more special.
Definitely. Like every 5 years is a big one, and like this is a 10-year one. So, and we missed the 2020 one due to COVID, and so it's been 10 years since our last big reunion, which has the parade and a few extra things that go down. We've got a History Maker Award going in this year. It'll be Greg Rhodes, who's passed recently, in the last couple of years. He's getting into the History Maker, and there's some very iconic people that will be getting inducted this year.
30 years is a long time. How have you seen the museum and the industry change here, particularly in the territory?
Yeah, it's like every industry or even the country, there's ups and downs. And we went through a bit of a hard stage there with one of the CEOs leaving, and then straight into COVID, which was just, we didn't have a reunion that year. And then we had like very low tourist numbers for, 2 or 3 years after COVID. And now this year has been definitely the best year we've had in the last five, easy.
You mentioned the return of the parade. We chatted earlier. Seems like there's already been a ton of interest in it already.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we've got 100 trucks already booked in. We were hoping to get to 140, and they're coming from every single state in Australia, including Tasmania. And so we'll have trucks from all over Australia. And then they're not only older trucks done up, there's a lot of brand new trucks in there. So there's a lot of chrome, a lot of bling that is really good for kids and for public to see,
Talk a little bit about the route for the rigs. They'll have the West McDonald's Rangers there in the background.
Yeah, that's right. We'll be starting at the hall, and then so we'll come down, go around the big Tom Brown roundabout, and then back out to the showgrounds for a show and shine, so that people can come and get up close to these big rigs and walk amongst them and talk to the drivers and the owners and hear some of their stories. That's all part of it,
Talking about big trucks, we're next to a bit of a big rig here. Talk a little bit about it and where it's been recently.
Yeah, so here we are standing next to the big Moonraker truck that been built for us. It's one of our GNS's old trucks, a 21-year-old, so it's a 2004 C501 Brute. And we recently took it to the Casino Truck Show down in New South Wales, where we got in the top 15 trucks and we won a trophy, which we're very proud of. And, so people will see that in the parade as well.
What does it mean for you? I can see my own reflection currently in the paint. You obviously have put a great deal of care and attention to detail. So what does it mean to be recognised for that?
Oh, it's massive. It's, we all dream of having a trophy-winning truck ever. Like most drivers would that's all you dream of all your life when you're sitting behind the wheel. And, it's to finally get one. It's been a lifelong ambition, and it makes an old man happy,
Are you hoping to bring some of the crowds and some of the excitement we saw in Casino here to the Red Centre?
Yeah, definitely. That's what we're hoping to, I'd love to see, the town come out and support us, to watch the parade, and then maybe you get around to the showgrounds to have a look at these trucks up close and have a bit of a chat to us all. We can go through it a bit more detail. Kids can climb up on them, get photos, and, that's what we like to target the children for, hopefully the next generation truckies. If they fall in love with these big trucks and the chrome and the shine, that's what we need. We need more drivers on the road later,
That's Franco Bellato from the National Road Transport Museum speaking to Charles Geary. So the Australian Festival of Transport, it's on soon. It's on between August 28 to August 31. Time now in the Country Hour to head to the sale yards with all the latest prices out of Roma. Here's David Friend.
Roma agents yarded 7,703 head. All the regular processed feedlots and background is present. Cattle were drawn from New South Wales as well as the normal supply district. A mixed quality yarding penned with the market solid throughout. at the time of this entry report. Yearling steers 200 to 280 kilos, sold from $3 to $5.52 a kilo. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos, made to $5.16 to restockers. Yearling steers over 480 kilos to $3.98 a kilo. Growing steers 400 to 500 to $4.80 to feed. Growing steers 500 to 600 kilos, made to $4.16 to processors. Bullocks over 600 kilos to $4.08, also to processors. Bulls over 600 kilos to $3.92 a kilo. This has been David from the National Livestock Reporting Service at Roma.
Thank you for that, David. Driving from the Kimberley back up to Darwin over the weekend, a lot of cattle trucks on the road, and there's a couple of ships due out of Darwin Port over the next sort of 6 to 7 days. That's it for this afternoon's Country Hour. Keep it rural.